Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
D-Mace, Vingen, and Donick, 102.5. The Game, Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingen, Connor Newt here with you. A reminder that at 5:20, Silly Underdog picks week two, and we will need a representative of the people. So be listening for your cue to call in the 5 o'clock hour. Let me tell you what the prize is if you pick correctly. You will win a pair of tickets to see Candlebox at Brooklyn Bowl on Sunday, October 11th.
One from the heyday.
A little grunge.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you're a fan of grunge, you can win a pair of tickets to see Candlebox at Brooklyn Bowl next month if you are the representative of the people and you win. So keep that in mind. Now, I don't know if our next guest is a fan of Candlebox, but let's go to our phone line, driven by Wilson County, Hyundai.com, and welcome in our friend, Tennessean columnist, Gentry Estes. Hello, Gentry. How are you?
Candlebox, like, I left me far behind. Is that song they had, Candlebox?
I'm not too familiar with Candlebox's discography.
I would say they were like a second tier, like below Nirvana and Soundgarden and Alice in Chains and groups like that, right? Green Day, you know, those were the big ones back there for that wave in the early to mid 90s. And then Candlebox was kind of like sliding under there. Two or three hits.
I'm going to ignore the fact that Willie Donick put Green Day in a conversation about grunge. We're going to have
I'm talking about more
of
the time.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, they weren't like the popish 80s tunes from, you know, 5 or 6 years before that everybody was listening to.
But we didn't have Gentry Estes on the program to talk about Candlebox. But you can win Candlebox tickets during Silly Underdog Picks. So, Gentry, you recently had an exclusive interview with Tennessee Titans offensive coordinator Brian Daboll. I really enjoyed the story. I highly recommend people go and read it at the Tennessean's website. First of all, I learned that Brian Daboll, apparently an amateur magician, I almost said musician, Candlebox on the mind, an amateur magician doing card tricks for you. I did think that was pretty interesting. But in the process of sitting down with Brian Daboll, getting to know him, picking his brain about what his role is in the development of Cam Ward, when you left his office, what was your main takeaway? What did you leave thinking most about after your conversation with Daboll?
I think Daboll is good for the Titans. You know, he comes across obviously as a very experienced, seasoned football coach who's been through. I mean, look, anybody whose two big mentors are Bill Belichick and Nick Saban is probably going to have a pretty good sense for how to coach football. It's interesting in his case because you're talking about two of the better defensive minds in football, and here's an offensive coach. So we talked about how he ended up coaching offense for Belichick and kind of, you know, basically learned the system from Charlie Weiss and guys like that. You know, it's funny, having a long conversation with him, it was the kind of thing where by far the most interesting parts were the things you can't report, the things that it's just me and him talking. Where he would kind of veer off the record so he could really talk to me, you know. And it was a good conversation. I think Daboll is good for the Titans. As I wrote, I think he was a good experienced hire for a bad inexperienced team. Now what that means for Cam Ward, look, we'll see. But I feel as though you know, they couldn't have done a whole lot better, in my opinion, for what they would have needed at OC than this guy.
Now, Gentry, I have had this one, I don't know if I want to call it a concern, maybe some skepticism about Brian Daboll. And disclaimer, I am not a ball knower the way that Derek Mason is a ball knower or our friend Teron Davenport is a ball knower. But my concern about Daboll is he's sort of coasting on his experience with Josh Allen. Daniel Jones had, you know, before last season, had his best season of his NFL career under Daboll, but it wasn't like Daniel Jones was lighting the world on fire. We saw some flashes from Jackson Dart last season before Daboll was fired by the Giants. But my skepticism is, I think there are some Titans fans out there who think that Daboll will do for Ward what Daboll helped Josh Allen do, and I think that's incredibly unrealistic. I think Allen is a one-of-one quarterback specimen. Tell me if you think I'm off base here by having that skepticism about Brian Daboll.
No, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, you're not just going to snap your fingers and turn any old quarterback into Josh Allen. I mean, yeah, that's a singular talent in a lot of ways. But I wouldn't overlook the fact that Daboll had other options. There are other places he could be right now. And this actually, to me, was a bit risky in terms of, you're talking about a guy who, this is a redemption arc in his career. Clearly, he wants to be a head coach again. And what happens this season in Tennessee is going to have a lot to do with whether or not he is. So he chose to be here and be a part of this. And I think it says that he had a lot of confidence in Robert Saleh, but I think he also had a lot of confidence in Cam Ward. He clearly wanted to work with him, going back to a lot of what the relationship they built during the pre-draft process. And when I asked him about that, I mean, he remembered basically how sharp Cam was in these meetings, the things that he was able to grasp on the whiteboard, the things that he was able to see on film and describe. And I think it really impressed Daboll to where, in addition to Cam's physical gifts, I feel as though he felt like there was a lot to work with here. I still think that's probably the case. We haven't seen it in some of the preseason games, but I think if you've been out to practice, I feel like there have been a few good days. I feel as though the offense, he started to settle in maybe a little more over the course of the preseason. He started to see a lot more completions to Wandale Robinson. The tight ends got more involved. So I think he started to see a little more about what this is supposed to look like. But I would agree. I mean, it's unfair to compare Cam to Josh Allen in the same way that it was always unfair to compare him to Patrick Mahomes when they first drafted him.
We'll talk with Gentry Estes of the Tennessean. Now, Gentry, you mentioned Cam Ward, and he was in an article. And Cam talked about how he trusted Daboll from day one and how Daboll, you know, took his input, you know, and sort of used it. And, you know, is that going to be more so what we see moving forward, that this offense is actually, you know, more so of Ward's input rather than Daboll's system?
I think so. Cam has said that on several instances now as one of the a first impression in terms of working with Daboll is that, you know, from right away, he said you could tell he's going to listen to me. You know, he's going to take my advice, what I'm comfortable with, what I want to do, and incorporate that. So I do. I think that's certainly a big part of what's going on. Yeah, you feel like, I mean, this is Daboll's eighth different NFL team that he's been on the coaching staff. He's been an offensive coordinator in five of those stops. So you don't do that as long as he has, and not all those quarterbacks were Josh Allen, and you don't do that as long as he has without, I think, developing some flexibility for what you have and what your quarterback and your offense, what suits what's going to work best is what you have. I think the strength of Daboll is he's not one of those offensive guys that, you know, bangs his fist on the table and we're doing it this way. This is my offense. This is how we do things. I think there's going to be some flexibility. I think it probably will fit into what Cam wants to do. I mean, he's still going to have to go out there and do it. And I think that's really what this is going to come down to, is how comfortable is he in this offense? How well can he execute in this offense? And he's just got to get out there and make the throws.
Now, you said that Daboll was good for the Titans, but you don't necessarily believe or think that the Titans are good for him. What did you mean by that? Is it because of this team, the record they've had over the last couple of years, and this team not quite developing? He's a guy that this may be his last shot at a head coaching situation?
Yeah. I mean, from the standpoint of, I mean, it's like I said, he had other options that would have been probably better bets in terms of, I want to get back to this level. And you know, you're joining a team with six wins the last couple of years with quite a few question marks still on that offense. I know they bulked up at receiver. But I mean, you know, I know the O-line had a good preseason, but
I think we're going to have to see it from this team, and especially this offense, to really believe that it's there. You're talking about an offense in the Titans. They haven't been better than, I think, 26th in the NFL in any season since they traded A.J. Brown. And that's a lot of different people trying to make this work who have not been able to make it work. So if he's able to do it, and he's able to make the Titans a formidable offense, make Cam Ward, you know, get a lot closer to the potential that a lot of people think's there for him, then I do think, yeah, it could pay off pretty big for Dable, and he could be head coach again somewhere next year. But the flip side of that is not very good.
We're talking to Gentry Estes from the Tennessean. Gentry, there's been a lot of fun discussion and observation of the interaction between Cam Ward and Brian Dable directly, and the emotions of both, the fieriness of both. And we've watched it. You could see it. People talk about it. What did you, when you talked to Brian Dable about that part, what is he like about it?
With Cam, you said?
With Cam, the interaction, not afraid to show their emotions to one another, get on each other, you know, that you hear about that. I'm curious if you got any insight.
He said, I think he likes the fire. I think he does. And he views himself as a fiery guy. Feels like Cam's going to be a good fit. Hey, look, there's a reason the Giants tried to trade up last year to get Cam Ward. A lot's been made out of that, but I think rightfully so now with how this has worked out, where Dable is actually getting to coach the guy. And I think all along he liked a lot about Cam Ward. And I think he also felt that it was a personality fit. And, you know, you hope for that with an OC and a quarterback. But I think Dable, and going back to what we've talked about with it's a bit of a risk for his career, I don't think he takes this job unless he really believes that Cam Ward is what the Titans hope he's going to turn into as a quarterback. And I think that that involves a lot of things that Dable doesn't have control over, but the things that he does, I feel like he probably feels like it's a good fit.
What do you think the influence of Nick Saban was? I know you talked to him about his time at Alabama, which is under the radar compared to, like you said, he's been 8 different places in the NFL. He's been a head coach in the NFL, but he did spend some time at Alabama with Nick Saban. What do you think his experience was there and the influence he got?
I did ask a good bit about that. That was one I was just personally interested in, being, you know, here in SEC country. The guy spent 1 year as a college offensive coordinator and won a national championship. Now, granted, most college offensive coordinators don't have both Tua and Jalen Hurts on their team, in addition to all kinds of receivers, including Calvin Ridley. But I feel as though it's hard to knock the results there. He was 1-for-1. It went back. His second year as a coach, he was a GA for Saban at Michigan State. So he ends up years later going back to join his staff at Alabama. If you remember, this was after the Lane Kiffin stretch where he was at Alabama. And, you know, it felt like there was always so much turnover with Saban's staff because his coaches kept getting other jobs because they kept winning so much. And I asked him whether or not he would have gone to go coach college football for anyone but Nick Saban. And he didn't say yes, but I think the fact that it was Saban had a lot to do with him being willing to take that chance. And it was interesting because he talked about how it changed him as a coach a little bit, because it made him a little more empathetic or understanding when it came to dealing with younger players. And, I think he, when you see what has happened with his career since then, I do think it helped him, sure.
Gentry, before we let you go, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here, if you don't mind. You wrote a column for the Tennessean yesterday reacting to the biggest story around here, the Tennessee Titans deciding to revoke our friend Jarrett Stillman's credentials. And as I just said, he's my friend, he's your friend, we're all friends with Jared. I don't support the Titans' decision to revoke his access. Clearly you don't. By the way, I love a good biting column. I love it. So I really enjoyed your story yesterday. But for the purpose of this discussion, I am going to play devil's advocate for just a moment. Are we absolving Jared of blame here? And let me again play devil's advocate. Since he went out on his own. His podcast is more incendiary than his radio show was. He uses more vulgarity on his podcast, of course, than he did in his radio show. The other day, I went back and listened to a show after the viral exchange with Cam Ward, and he referred to the Titans as, and I quote, a bunch of P-words, and he did not censor himself like I just did. I do not support the Titans' decision. Their play deserves criticism. But have we glossed over Jared's role in this?
I say no, but I'm going to say no, because to me, the fact that it was Jared in this instance, it wasn't really about that to me. It was about an NFL team trying to control the message by intimidating the media. And whether or not that was spoken, and I say this as someone who was at the facility yesterday when all this went down, it was unspoken intimidation. It was a message that was received as, look, you know, we're not on a witch hunt to take away credentials, but you know, but the reasoning for this that was given was, you know, basically journalistic standards or integrity. And the Titans were basically telling us that they feel as though they have the authority to decide what journalistic integrity and standards are and what they'll allow. And they don't have that ability. The journalists get to decide that. We don't work for the Titans. I don't work for the Titans, just like I don't work for Vandy, UT, the Preds, you know, National SC, any other team. But the difference is, all those other teams don't try to do this. They don't try to control the message the way the Titans do. And while this to me with Jared was a new low for them trying to do this, it wasn't new. This is a team that has been very sensitive to criticism for a while now. And I feel as though they misstepped pretty badly in this situation. I think it's a terrible look for the team. It makes the team look, it's a distraction at a bad time. It makes the team just look soft. It reflects making Cam Ward look soft. And I don't think Cam deserves that in this instance, but because it was he had the exchange with Jared and then this happens, it makes it look like Cam was upset and they were, I don't think that was the case, but that's how the rest of the NFL is going to perceive it. And I just think it's a terrible look to me to make it about Jared and what he's doing glosses over what's really happening here, which is a sports team's trying to control the narrative. And that never goes very well, especially when the team isn't winning.
I think that's a fair point. Gentry Estes of the Tennessean has been our guest on D-Mace, Vingan and Donick. I do suggest you go read his story, his exclusive interview with Brian Daboll. Gentry, as always, a pleasure. We'll do it again soon.
You bet. Take care, guys.
615-737-1025. Coming up next, the SEC and LSU are preparing for a potential showdown in court. We'll discuss that coming up next, 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game.
In my opinion, hands down, the SEC is going to win this case. I don't think there's any question about it.
Why?
Well, like most legal questions, that could be a long answer, but I'll put it this way. Having dealt with the NCAA many, many times, having handled the Chambliss case, you can see his signed jersey behind me. Mm-hmm. I totally understand how the law works in this area, but the SEC is vastly different than the NCAA when it comes to the legal claim that the plaintiffs are advancing. It is not going to be possible for them to sustain that claim. Now, we have a temporary restraining order, which by definition is temporary. The judge in the Baton Rouge case is going to be under immense political pressure to rule.
That was veteran attorney Tom Mars discussing the potential showdown looming tomorrow in Baton Rouge court between the SEC and LSU, Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan here with you. In case you've been living under a rock, college football season right around the corner. I mean, it's already started, but week one is right around the corner, not this week zero that Derek Mason hates and doesn't have to worry about anymore. But LSU and Lane Kiffin are trying to add players who were in the NFL this preseason to the Tigers roster. And the SEC said, over our dead body. And look, there's a lot of legal mumbo jumbo in all of this. And we're not lawyers. We're not fancy pants lawyers like Tom Mars. But here's the crux of it from ESPN. There's a court hearing Thursday in state court in Baton Rouge where a judge will decide whether or not to issue a preliminary injunction. The injunction would be expected to also cover both the SEC and Commissioner Greg Sankey, who were named in an amended temporary restraining order on Friday. If the judge issues an injunction, LSU will then have to decide to risk potential consequences and potential legal action from the SEC if the players in question are formally added to the roster. So how do we think this is all going to go tomorrow?
If I had that crystal ball, I'd be rich right now. You just don't know. Listen, the SEC is standing on what they said, and the courts made their ruling, and now they're going back. What if the judge says, you know what, I'm going to uphold my ruling? And then it just seems like two people that are dug in. Will LSU, here's the thing, and I don't think SEC will, this is why I don't think they will budge. And maybe the whole Lane Kiffin thing, he assumes to not really care about players because of what he's doing. They don't think that the university will put those players in a position where they then forfeit games. You have them going out there and play with a guy that, yeah, the court said he can play, but the SEC is saying he can't, and y'all will. There are penalties if he does play. There has to be leaders on the team saying, we don't. This is not something we need to do, because he plays. We win our first six or seven games. Those games mean nothing now, nothing. And what are you explaining to those young men that went out there and bust their tails before these two guys got here?
Yeah, I don't think Lane Kiffin explained that to his quote, leadership group. Say, hey, guys, I just want to lay it all out here. There is a chance that if we play these guys, that we might have to forfeit games or I could get suspended. Do you think it didn't sound like that was part of the narrative. He certainly didn't refer to that when he was excited to tell this media outlet that, hey, my leadership guy, they want these guys on the team. Do they? Did they know all of that? I don't know. But here's my thought. You can't sit around worried about the worst case scenario that a judge might do. The way, you know, at some point, as a league, you've got to stand up and say, okay, the judge can do whatever he wants. We're a league. We are teams that choose to be in this league. We play by rules. And we all agree on this rule. So, LSU, if you want to be the renegade and you want to try to play these guys, let's fight. At some point, Kiffin is forcing the fight. And so I think you have to gauge, too, how does the public feel about it? I think the public is very, I don't say unanimous, but very close on unanimous. I think philosophically, we believe that when you sign an NFL contract, you should not go back and play college football. And so if that's the case, then I think you go full force and say, I don't care what the judge says on Thursday. Here are our rules in the SEC. If you want to sue us, if you want to go down that road for a backup tight end and an extra defensive lineman, go right ahead.
Here are some notes about this. From ESPN.com, if the SEC takes immediate action to punish LSU, the league would be violating a standing court order issued by a state judge in Louisiana that prohibits the SEC and Greg Sankey from enforcing any rules, including conference-wide bans on pro players, that would keep the players involved in an ongoing lawsuit off the field. The SEC passed strong penalties last week in Birmingham for breaking the NFL to college rule, which includes suspending a coach for half a season, loss of half of the sport's annual budget, and a revocation of league voting rights. Sankey also has the authority for additional sanctions. The president of the SEC's executive committee, Tennessee Chancellor Donde Plowman, told ESPN, quote, "We have a responsibility to try and lead the best we can in this time of chaos. Our group is united on this. This is not a rule we will budge on. Enough is enough."
So is it limited to, can he then come back and say, because they said additional penalties, can he say, well, we're going to suspend, if the judge upholds it, then they come back as a committee and say, well, if Lane plays any of his players, those games will be forfeited. If he plays a down, a second, those games will be forfeited. Are they able to do that? Because it said it would be violating the court order if indeed they do impose sanctions. I'm thinking about this. Yeah, because we're not lawyers and we don't pretend to play one either. But I'm just trying to think about this, you know, holistically in a sense. But then, two, as a former player, I think about it from this standpoint too. Coaches preach like it's the we, and right, don't do anything that's going to hurt us all, and removing distractions and removing players from programs that seems to be knuckleheads and is bringing a program. But then you do something like this. Like, you are putting your players, do LSU not see it, or they just don't give a damn? You are putting your players at risk of them playing a season that is not going to mean anything if indeed you put that player, those two players, on the football field.
Willie, the question that LSU and Lane Kiffin have to ask themselves is this worth it? Is this whole thing worth it? As you mentioned, I don't know everything about the players involved, but it sounds like the tight end who was on the Cleveland Browns in the preseason, who's now trying to get on LSU, is not even going to be the Tigers' starting tight end. Is this all worth it? Will Lane Kiffin concede if this doesn't go his way? Or are we just going to be tied into courts for the next several months?
I think what the SEC and really all of the Power Four teams are trying to do is they're trying to act as a collective. We all agree these guys shouldn't play. If you want to be the one guy that gets one judge, and if you're a cynic, you say that judge has been orchestrated by LSU to rule for these guys. Like, there's a conflict of interest almost to make a guy in Louisiana say, hey, this might help LSU if I get these guys. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm sure there is some legal basis, but at some point, it's about what the league believes as a whole, what college football believes as a whole. And make it be about that. And if you have an entire league that thinks one way, then I do think if you want to fight that battle, then fight it. But you can't be intimidated, and you can't be worried about the worst case scenario of one judge making a ruling on something that everybody believes is wrong. You got to go about your business. And their legal out is, we're not saying he's ineligible to play college football. We're just saying he cannot play in this league. And this is our league, and we make the rules in our league. Go play college football somewhere else.
Can you, because the ruling was made the minute they, you know, put in the 5 for 5, right? Then the judge made the ruling, or they took it to the judge and, you know, and he made the ruling on getting that extra year. So if that is indeed the case, and they could have done it before, but I'm just thinking, if they did it right after that rule was put in place for 5 for 5, do you blame a judge because you rushed through the 5 for 5? Did you not put in provisions like this? Did you not think that possibly something like this was going to happen? So I don't necessarily, even though the judge may, I don't necessarily blame the judge, because you did not establish a rule saying, yes, 5 for 5, but if you have already entered into the NFL draft and was on a NFL team, you no longer qualify. Was that in there for the 5 for 5? If it wasn't, then that gave a judge a reason to side with LSU in a sense, probably not necessarily because they wanted to, because there was ambiguity in what they said. Am I right or am I wrong?
Look, I'm so fatigued about this whole
I'm
thing.
I'm just saying, like...
But it comes down to this. Let's simplify it. What do we believe is right?
I know what's
should,
right,
should
yes.
NFL player... This is,
no,
let's forget about
right.
the 5 for 5. Because I think all of that is being brought up with mm-hmm. the arguments being made by all these lawyers and the judges and all that stuff and influencing the judge who probably doesn't know if a ball is pumped or stuff half the time. I don't know. I don't know what
PSI?
They know. Are they football fans? Who I mean, they used to talk about baseball arbitration cases mm-hmm. and stuff, and an arbitrator might ask something like, what is an RBI? Right? You're convincing somebody who's not in the game. It's a judge. It's impartial, but it's not somebody that maybe knows the interest. But everybody agrees. If you sign an NFL contract, you shouldn't play college football. Mm-hmm. I would just keep banging away at that.
Seems simple enough. 615-737.
I mean, do we really want to make it more complicated than that?
They have, though.
I don't. Lane Kiffin. And I do wonder this. Lane Kiffin and LSU are about to play Clemson, who they should beat. And they're playing at home. But do you think that they're focused at practice every day with all this going on? Can Lane Kiffin be at his best? He's a heck of a football coach. I think we would all agree. He's a good mm-hmm. coach. But will this have an effect on how they prepare, how ready to play they are on Saturday? I don't know. There's a lot of expectations.
It's a good question. 615-737-1025. We'll see. Soon enough, Silly Underdog Picks coming up at 520. I believe last I checked, Clemson was a 10-point underdog at LSU. So maybe that could be on the table. 615-737-1025. We have a lot of reaction to the Luke Evangelista trade. The Nashville Predators last night traded Luke Evangelista to the New Jersey Devils. We've got a lot of leftover reaction and more reaction about the trade on our text line. We'll get to that coming up next. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 102.5 The Game. Ace Vingan and Donick, 102.5 The Game. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan here with you. A reminder, Silly Underdog Picks coming up at 5:20, presented by our friends at Volunteer Hose and Gasket. The prize, if you are the people's representative and you win, you will win a pair of tickets to see Candlebox. Yes, Candlebox at Brooklyn Bowl on Sunday, October 11th. By the way, I haven't been to Brooklyn Bowl, but I hear it's a great venue. I see a lot of good shows there, like in terms of like on the calendar. I've never been to a show there, but maybe you can be at Candlebox at Brooklyn Bowl on October 11th, and tell me about it. 615-737-1025. That coming up in about 40 minutes. But in the meantime, we've got a lot of leftover reaction to the trade last night. The Nashville Predators trade Luke Evangelista to the New Jersey Devils for a 2028 first-round pick and a 2028 second-round pick. One texter says, Chris McFarland is a breath of fresh air. So far, I would agree with that. You know me, when the news broke that Barry Trotz was retiring, the first thing I said that day was the next GM needs to be someone with zero ties to the organization. I know that that was a popular opinion. And the one thing I do like about Chris McFarland so far, and again, I'm still getting to know Chris McFarland, and Chris McFarland will join our show throughout the hockey season, not as frequently as Barry Trotz, but he will join the program throughout the show. But the one thing that I do like about the hiring of Chris McFarland is he has zero emotional attachment to any of the players who have been here. And I think you saw an example of that last night when he traded a fan favorite. Because let's not be mistaken. Luke Evangelista, absolutely a fan favorite. In the meantime, let's go to our phone line, driven by Wilson County, Hyundai.com, and welcome in Ryan. Ryan, thank you for calling. Please go ahead.
Hey guys. It is what it is. I mean, they got a great value for a guy that took in the second round, and they're getting a first and a second, which they can use later on for trade up or trade for a player. But the other thing you got to look at is McFarland said there are too many right-handed players on the offense, which is, makes it a little hard on a power play when you're trying to get that one-timer on both sides. When you have Stamkos who's going to shoot on the left side, who's a right-handed shot, you don't got anyone that can do it on the left side. On the right side, that's a left-handed shot. So it comes, your power play, it comes a little bit more one-dimensional. And also the fact is, look at when he was an RFA with Trotz to get the deal he's on now. He drug it out all summer long. If I'm not mistaken, this time around, he qualified for arbitration. If I'm not mistaken. So this could become even a bigger thing if he's set on making $7 million or plus, and what the points and analytics say he's supposed to be. If he's set on that and he takes the team to arbitration, this could become a long, drawn-out process, and maybe Chris McFarland doesn't want to have to deal with that.
Thank you for the call, Ryan. We did have another texter, Willie, ask us if, as Ryan said there, if the contract situation with Luke Evangelista last season played into the role of him being played a role in him being traded last night. My understanding is that it did not have a serious factor in the decision to trade Luke Evangelista. But as we talked about earlier, clearly Chris McFarland, look, he's got a team of people, a beefed up team of people to help him make all of these decisions. And clearly he and his team believe that whatever Luke Evangelista's next contract is going to be, we've speculated between $8 and $9 million per season. McFarland did not believe that value was worth it for Evangelista.
I think where the contract comes in, and Chris McFarland said the contract did not have to do with the trade, and I think directly that was the case. But, and McFarland said, Luke Evangelista, for this coming year, is great value for what he has become. If you wind the clock back last year, he was coming off, I think how I would say it would be a sophomore slump where his stock was down. You had the holdout, and I think they were a little bit more murky on where they thought his career was going. And to Luke's credit, he hung in there, and he had an excellent year. And if you could roll the clock back, if you knew then what you know now, and hindsight is always 20/20, but maybe the move would have been to lock him up at a price where it would fit exactly where you think his value is. But while the contract may not have played a direct role, I think where the market is going and where he is going to fit based on all the speculation you see, the players that are comparable are now getting $7, $8, $9 million a year. I do think that was part of the decision of, can we make it happen without this guy? Are we better off with him, with all the right-handed shots? And Ryan is right. For example, Maverick Bork is a right-handed shot. Vitaly Pinchuk, who is a big X factor in all of this, because you have no idea what you're getting when you bring in a KHL guy. Pinchuk could be a guy that in 3 months we say, why did they do that? Why did they bring this guy in? Or he could be, hey, a really nice surprise. There were a lot of teams that wanted Vitaly Pinchuk. He's a left-handed shot. So I think these are all things that Chris McFarland is gambling of how they're going to replace Luke Evangelista and take the assets that they got for him and then use them to improve the roster in other areas, which is what he said. And I think if you want to get more specific, reading between the lines, it's on defense.
One texter says to Ryan's call, bad take. I hate when people tie value to where they were drafted. Is that good value for a 24-year-old that just came off a 56-point season? I would say yes.
I think it's excellent value.
I would say it's excellent value. As Willie said, if you had told us a year ago that the Predators could have gotten that package for Luke Evangelista, I think we all would have snickered a little bit. But my point earlier was you are now removing a top-six player from your lineup, one who had nearly 60 points last season, one who spent most of his time playing alongside Ryan O'Reilly and Philip Forsberg and Steven Stamkos, and the Predators do not have a ready-made player to replace Luke Evangelista. So the team is worse today than it was before the trade last night. We will see if McFarland is able to swing another deal, and if he acquires a top-four defenseman with the assets he acquired from the Luke Evangelista trade, we will think about it differently. But that was my question earlier in the show. Does this trade mean that the Predators are possibly embarking on a rebuild? The Predators, I was surprised by this. The Predators have only missed the playoffs in three consecutive seasons once in their history. And that was the first 5 years of their existence when they were a lowly expansion franchise. If the Predators miss the playoffs again this season, that will be three, if my math is right, three consecutive years.
Yep.
Without the playoffs.
That, four out of five?
Yeah, that's futility unheard of, really, in Predators history. And it leads me to wonder how fans would react to that.
But this, again, goes back to our philosophical, you know, what are the different ways to rebuild rather than break it all the way down to the bottom? Because I think they view it as that they have quietly been rebuilding for 4 or 5 years with all of the draft capital and assets that they have built up. And let's not forget, they are in the top 10 in pretty much every prospect pool that you can find. True?
Yes.
And what that's going to give them, we don't know. But it's not like the cupboard is bare and they have to start from scratch. They've been building behind the scenes. They've acquired a ton of draft capital. How many first and second round picks do they have over the next few years?
9 total over the next 3 years.
4 first round picks, 5 second round picks over the next how many years?
3.
That's a lot of draft capital. And you can utilize that in a lot of different ways. And I think you heard Chris McFarland, A, really back, guys. He mentioned by name Igor Surin, who can't play on the team until after his season is over in the KHL. Brady Martin, who I don't know if you can expect from day one this season is going to make an impact, but they want to leave a runway for those guys. They believe those guys are going to help them in the next 2 to 3 years. So as far as the rebuild, it's going to hinge on, can they take these assets they got for Evangelista and get immediate help on the defense? I think that is, because I think you could listen to what he said last night and almost make the argument. He almost, you could say, you trying to read his mind, which we can't. I've got a deal I might be able to make, but I needed some more things in the hopper to put in a trade package to get the guy I want. Now, whether he's talking about a specific guy or he's got a group of players that he thinks could be available, and if he had a little bit more to offer, he could maybe pry them loose, I don't know. Because he said there could be another trade in 3 weeks. It could be 3 months. But they want to take what they got for Evangelista and then turn it into something. That will tell you the direction that they're going to try to head in this year. But I think the priority, Adam, is to be a great team over the next 2 or 3 years and not just scratch your way into the wild card this year, right? And, you know, that one's got to prioritize over the other. If they get off to a good start and you have a good year, then great, go with it. And if they go south like they did two seasons ago and become irrelevant, then I think your decision is easy in terms of other guys that would have great trade value, and then you go in that direction.
One texter says, Luke is not a game changer. He's not someone I'm worried about in the playoff series at all. He's not worth a $7 to $8 million contract per year, regardless of the cap going up. There is a lot more excitement with guys like Lee, Surin, and Martin, and that is true. But none of those players probably are going to make a tangible impact this season.
Right. Well, we know Surin isn't.
Right.
Unless he is joining for the playoffs or somehow. That's the earliest he could possibly even get here. So take him out of the mix. Brady Martin is 19 years old.
Around there, right?
Riker Lee is 19 years old. Mike Riker Lee's playing for Michigan State. He's not going to help you this year.
Right. So
maybe Martin, but we don't know.
But here's my point. Whenever we had these conversations about rebuilds last season, and a lot of you piled on me because you don't like the idea of watching a hockey team that is struggling, perhaps on purpose, it's possible that this season is going to be that. It is possible. The Predators aren't throwing in the proverbial white towel, but they may not be a playoff contender this season. And if you're okay with looking a year or two in the future and resting on that, totally
right.
Fine.
But define playoff contender. I don't think anybody is crazy enough to think they're a Stanley Cup playoff contender. I think, is it realistic to say you could have a really good year and get into the wild card? Yeah, I think that's realistic. I think every year there are some teams that just have good years. Last year they had a horrendous first quarter of the season and still were in the playoff race for the last week. And there's benefits to that. and you want to give your team a chance to go down the road. I don't like starting the season saying we're waving the white flag. That's a completely different thing than I think what they're doing. I think they want to be good this year. But if it doesn't go well, the big picture, what was the first thing that Chris McFarland said as to why he took the job? We had one question for Bill Haslam. What was the question?
He said, are we content with making the playoffs as a wild card team and high-fiving and celebrating that, or do we want to be a team that competes for the Stanley Cup? And Haslam said the latter, and that's all McFarland said he needed to hear.
Right, so that's the priority, is to build a Stanley Cup winning team. They're not that right now, but there's a lot of other things you can do in the meantime while you build that roster. And so I think that's what we're going to wait and see. But I believe, and I don't know this, but if you, again, listen to Chris McFarland's press conference, it sounds to me like he's got an idea of what he would like to do with the first and second round pick or this bundle of assets you've got, knowing that Evangelista is gone, you've got other guys you feel good about. What can you do with those assets?
Two quick texts. One texter says, Adam for assistant GM. They've got a lot of people doing that job, and they're a lot more qualified than me. Craig says, as a season ticket holder and a fan who likes McFarland and doesn't want to see him get fired for poor team performance, the only good thing that would come from a rebuild is we would no longer have to hear Adam talk about the team doing a rebuild. I was just asking the question. That's all. 615.
Okay. Can I say one more thing in closing here?
Yes.
Because we said this in the first hour, but I want to make sure people know this. I am a huge fan of Luke Evangelista. He is a pro. He really embraces the connection between team and fan. He will do anything the team wanted him to do in terms of acting the fool on the video, you know, making fun of himself. Pretty boy Vincenzo. He wasn't like, hey, I don't want to be that. You know, he embraced it. He's a really good self-made hockey player that does what he does very, very well. It came down to, what is he going to be worth in his next contract? Where is the team going? What is the value of his player? And that's a tough, tough call. If they had decided to keep him and pay him big money, I wouldn't have been disappointed. But I can see why you wouldn't think what he does is, what did the guy call it? Game breaker, playoff impact guy. We're not sure what he's got there in that. So it looks like that's the determination that Chris McFarland made.
615-737-1025. Before we get to silly underdog picks at 520, I want to play a clip coming back that, look, one of my favorite things about this job, it doesn't happen very often, but one of my favorite things about this job is making Willie Donick a little angry, because it doesn't happen very often. He is as mild-mannered as they come, which is why we're such good friends, but every now and then I like to needle him a little bit. And there's a clip I want to play that might indeed do that. Coming up next, 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game.
I'll play the Bruce Feldman clip. Oh, we're doing that here?
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.